We have an expression in Africa where it translated, it would say, I guess, a daughter of the soil. I believe that who I am is, I can never take that out of me. It's such a proud part of my identity.
Earlier this year, looking into events going on in Ontario related to personal growth and professional growth and development, I came across an event in Vaughan that was right up my alley. I booked it right away. It was an event that aligned with my values in ways that no other event that I'd ever attended in the past had before. Welcome to the Safe Haven, a space for stories to be shared about the lights and darks, highs and lows of life. Sandra Chuma is from Zimbabwe. She's a storyteller, a filmmaker, a podcaster, and an entrepreneur. Sandra's passion in storytelling, empowering women, and sharing stories helped ignite her desires to create the Woman on Fire Summit, the inaugural event of which was supposed to have taken place April 5th of this year.
I have a platform, so I have a podcast called Ndini. And Ndini is really focused on telling the stories of inspiring and trailblazing women of African descent. And I was very specific about telling those stories because they're stories that we don't often hear, and they're stories that are typically in the media have a very negative connotation. And I wanted a platform from myself, because I, as a woman who is from Africa, I'm from Zimbabwe, I was looking for where can I find stories of women who've come from where I've come from, who are doing amazing things in the world. So that's how that platform started. And then once I've started it, a lot of the feedback that I was getting from the community was, we'd love to have in-person events. We'd love to get together in person and, you know, break bread together, look at each other in the whites of our eyes. And I've never done events. I've never even planned a birthday party. My poor child went through life having other people plan her birthday parties. And so I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know where to start. And I was fortunate in that I did get hooked up with a wonderful creative team called Creative Label. And when I went into the very first conversation with them about what did I want, my mind was very much on that. I'm going to create an event that is for women of color to come together and have conversation. That was where my mind was at. But a couple of things happened. Actually, three things happened. I went to a summit where I heard an incredible woman speak. Her name is Haben Girma. If you've never heard of her, look her up. Mm-hmm. She's blind, she's deaf, and she graduated from Harvard Law School. A phenomenal woman and a phenomenal story. But she said something when I heard her speak. She was talking about it from the perspective of people who are differently abled. And she said how, you know, a lot of the time people go about to create their own little societies and, you know, so that they can be together with people who look like them. But she said, different is not equal. And I thought, gosh, like literally, I remember sitting up in my chair and thinking, whoa, I'm trying to create this event, which is about bringing together people who are different because they don't normally see themselves represented, but I'm not really creating an equal platform. And then very shortly after that, I went to a different event. So apparently the universe really meant for me to hear this. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the movement called Move the Dial, or the organization Move the Dial. And they have an incredible woman who started it, who's the founder, who's the head of it, and her name is Jodi Kovacs. And Jodi, in her opening remarks at that summit, said that we all have good intentions, but we need to be intentional when it comes to diversity and how we represent diversity. Yes. And for me, it felt like the universe is speaking to me, because here I am trying to create this event, which is in and of itself exclusive in some way, because I'm tailoring it to women of African descent, women of color. And yet I had been frustrated so many times when I've gone to events and I've gone to, you know, gatherings, and there's nobody who looks like me. And I felt like, why are we in all these silos where, you know, we're having events in our little silos and we never ever get together? Because ultimately, inspiration, all of that is the same. You know, whether I'm a Black woman, a white woman, I'm inspired by the same things. And so that then was kind of my pivot. And then a friend of mine, her name is Nkechi Nwafor Robinson, I was telling her that, hey, you know, I'm creating this summit and oh my gosh, it's going to be exciting. And she made a suggestion to me about a speaker. And she said, oh my gosh, you should get so-and-so. And I said, oh, I can't have that person. And she said, why not? And I said, oh, because they're white. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me, it was the look on her face like, what the what? Like,
yeah.
And I'm like, and then I was trying to explain to her that, well, I'm creating this event because I wanted to be a woman of color and I want to have women of color speakers because we don't often get opportunities to be on stages. And she just kind of looks at me like, are you crazy? And so those three things, which happened in very quick succession, were the trigger for me to sit back and say, I'm part of the problem. I'm trying to create the thing that frustrates me most when I go to events that is very homogenous is exactly what I'm trying to create. Mm. So how do I create an event that is inclusive in terms of who the speakers are, in terms of who's invited and the messaging? So that really was the birth of Women on Fire Summit. And what I wanted was to create a day where women could come together and be inspired, be uplifted, have the opportunity to hear messages that are transformative. Because I understand as well the energy of being in a room and the energy of seeing a speaker on stage. And so that's really what I wanted, was to create an opportunity for how could we bring women together to light the fire on their lives. Mm-hmm. That was really what I wanted.
Was this year supposed to be the first one?
Yes, this was the very first one. This was our inaugural year.
Yeah, because literally the succession, like I just looked at how everything rolled, how it was laid out, the website, the social media, just everything. And here's me thinking like, oh, obviously I've missed it the last couple of years. This has to be well established because of the caliber of guests that you are going to have and the panel that you had lined up. Like I just thought that there's no way that this is the first round. So I'm really surprised actually to hear that this would have been the first year for it.
Funny you say that, the caliber of speakers and panelists. Number one, I have to give a lot of credit to the creative team that I worked with because we worked together. We worked incredibly hard to think about who are the speakers that we wanted, who are the speakers that would really speak to what we were trying to achieve. And then going out to the speakers, so actually one of our keynote speakers, our two main keynote speakers are Lisa Nichols and Gabby Bernstein. Mm-hmm. And Lisa Nichols said no initially. They said exactly what you said. We don't do first year events. You don't really have a significant following that would make sense for Lisa to attend. And so no, maybe when you're a little bit more established, come back to us. But I was so determined that what we were going to do was going to be at such a, I wanted it to be beautiful. I wanted it to be inspiring. I wanted it to so that no one would walk away feeling like they'd been served sloppy seconds. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the tone would be set by who are the speakers. And with Gabby, that was really, I had met her through a friend. Lewis Howes is a friend of mine, and he knows Gabby. And so I'd met her through that, but then Creative Label, my creative partners, also then kind of reached out to her. And I guess the pitch of what it was we were trying to achieve is what compelled her mm-hmm. to say yes, because, you know, she does turn down a lot of stuff. Like for her, she has no need to be getting on an airplane and coming to speak anywhere. She does just fine on her own. Mm-hmm. And so it really was, I think, the message of what we were trying to achieve and what we're trying to put out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same with all our panelists. You know, again, we just went to all of them and said, look, this is what we want to do. This is what we're trying to achieve. This is the goal of this. And they were all of them so incredibly gracious in giving us their yes.
Well, I can't wait for it to come around because I knew that you were so gracious and just offering a refund in tickets. I just kept it in there because I said, you know what? This is an event that no matter when it happens, I need to be there.
And I am so grateful to people like you because, you know, when everything said, and we were, if I kind of back up to us making the decision to postpone, we were actually one of the early ones.
Yes,
to
you were. Yep.
And at that time, like, it wasn't a thing yet in North America. COVID was not a thing yet in North America. And yet, like, we could see, like, we had long discussions with my creative team, and it was great to have them by my side and have them so invested with me because we're like, do we, don't we? What are the pros of this? What are the cons if we don't cancel? But ultimately, it came down to, I felt like we had a responsibility, regardless of what was going to happen in the world. And at that point, we didn't know it would become what it's become. But I felt like, what if we have a guest who lives with somebody who's vulnerable or has a relative who's vulnerable, comes and then passes it on. And then in some way, we were connected with somebody, you know, having an unfortunate outcome. Mm-hmm. That was what drove us. And the fact as well that we had people who were coming in from all over. Mm-hmm. Like, we literally had, you know, people who were coming in from Barbados and the Bahamas and Europe and wherever. And I thought, gosh, like, all these people, if we don't make a decision, if we're not leaders in some way, if we don't make a decision, all these people are investing money in flights and hotel and all of that. I don't really want to feel like I didn't make the responsible choice. Mm-hmm. So we did announce that we were postponing. And I remember actually when we made the announcement, we had so many people write and say or DM and say, why? Why are you postponing? Like, what's wrong?
Yeah.
Like, this, and it, I mean, it was only a matter of weeks later that everything happened. But yeah, it was a hard choice. And I, because ultimately, you know, as they say, the buck stopped with me. I had to make the ultimate decision. And I had a couple of days where I was like, am I making the right decision? Mm-hmm. Am I making the right decision? But yeah, things turned out the way they turned out.
Oh my gosh, for sure.
We definitely are going to do it. Like, definitely. And that was one of the things that I was so grateful for, is that every single one of our speakers committed and said, when the time is right, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. None of us is bailing on this. We're absolutely going to do it. We just have to wait until the time is right for us to figure out when do we do it, but we will do this. So that's been so comforting to me. And then I had people like you who had bought tickets, who had made the investment in a ticket, and I've been blown away, honestly blown away, because we offered it as a refund. I know other events did not offer a refund. Yeah. They pretty much said, you get to move your ticket to when we next have the event. But we were like, you know what? I don't want to feel like I'm holding you hostage because I'm not able to give you an answer. If I was able to say, this is the date that we're moving to, that's a different conversation. Mm-hmm. And so we really made the offer that anybody who wanted a refund could get a full refund. Mm-hmm. And I was blown away by the number of people who wrote, who DM'd, who said, you know what, when you're ready to have this event, I'm going to be there. So I don't want a refund. And it's truly like literally brought tears to my eyes.
Oh, for sure. And when you look at the clarity that you have now on the entire decision, and obviously that you did make the right one. Yes, it might have seemed like it was early to have made, but now with the knowing that you have, that you did the right thing, oh my gosh. And now think forward to how much more magical and valuable that event is going to be with what we've been through and the perspectives that are going to come forward from this time into that event.
I absolutely agree with you that, gosh, that's the one thing that I'm hearing so much of, is how much we're craving that physical connection. Mm-hmm. That, yes, we've learned, we've adjusted to, you know, having to connect, you know, via phone, computer, whatever the case may be. But gosh, you know, we sure miss giving each other hugs.
Oh, yeah. How have you been keeping busy during this time?
Oh my gosh, I feel like I've been busier. And so for Women on Fire specifically, Women on Fire Summit, we've continued in terms of, you know, there was a lot for us to do because we were literally, what, 3-4 weeks out from the event. So at that point, we had all our sponsors lined up. In fact, right now, like, our house is just, I have boxes and boxes. All the sponsors and shipped their stuff to me. So I have boxes of stuff. And so there was a lot of work to do there in terms of, going back to our sponsors who are all, oh my gosh, phenomenal in their support, to have those conversations, to go back to our speakers and have the conversations, and also just to keep the platform. Because one of the things we recognize too is we have a responsibility, because we have an audience. We have these people who had committed to, coming to the event, and we need to give them something that can be of value to them in this time. So in that sense, it's been busy. And then, of course, I have my podcast, so that's been keeping me busy as well. It's been an opportunity for me to really, in many ways, step back and think about the direction that I want to go and, what are some of the things, the hopes, the dreams, the aspirations that I have for both platforms. And then it's also been an opportunity. My husband is my business partner in many things, and he's had two big projects that he'd started, but time had never been right to kind of get them launched. So working on those is keeping me, I feel like I'm busier now.
I feel like a lot of different people have different things that are keeping them busy right now. And I'm always super curious, because we have all experienced these bad days too. I mean, we're experiencing some bad days. We're experiencing some emotional highs and lows as well. What personal practices do you have to maintain your mental health and well-being?
One of the things that has become my cornerstone of how I've got through this has been what I've started as a morning routine. It's been the one thing that has allowed me to feel some sense of normalcy in a very abnormal time. Mm-hmm. I think that's been the biggest thing, the routine. And what I recognized as well, because it has also given me a lot of time for reflection. Mm-hmm. What I recognized is that some of the things that you do, some of the learning that you have, is not to prepare you for when things are good, is to prepare you for times like these. Mm-hmm. So, specifically, as I said, to my morning routine was something that I had started as everybody had a morning routine, so I needed to have a morning routine too. And my morning routine really is focused on, I start my day every day in meditation. And it sounds way fancier than it is, but just really taking time in the morning to meditate on who I want to be, how I want to be in that day, and also to be grateful for all the blessings that I have in my life. And so particularly the gratitude has been a big one for me, because I think it's been hard some days to find the gratitude, to find things to be grateful for. Like, there's so much that it felt like was taken away from us. So being conscious and deliberate about every day, what are five things that I truly feel gratitude about? Not just write a list, but to actually stop and feel gratitude. So that's been a big thing for me. And the other thing that I added as well since being in lockdown has been being proud of myself.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and literally writing down three things. I make it three things that I'm proud of that I did or didn't do in a day, because I feel like we go through life just chasing the next and the next and the next, and rarely ever taking time to acknowledge ourselves for some of these things. And some days, especially in this lockdown time, I've been proud of myself that I didn't bite my husband's head off. Right? Yeah. He left the damn lid off the toothpaste or whatever. but it's just really gratitude and what can I be proud of myself about that happened today.
What a beautiful practice. And I recognize that you write these things daily, and it could vary per day. Like, what did you do today that you feel very proud of? And whether it is not bite your husband's head off, or whether it was, practice yoga, or whether it was go for a walk or connect with a friend or eat well all day or drink three bottles of water. I don't know. Could be anything, right? But you're acknowledging yourself. Usually towards the end of the podcast, I love to ask a couple questions. But one of them is, I'm going to ask you right now, if I was to ask you the one question, what are you most proud of? What's your answer?
I'm so proud of the woman that I'm becoming. Mm-hmm. And that's been a hard thing for me to get to to say I'm proud of me, to say that, you know what, I actually really like me. Because it's been such a journey, and I think that so much of our society is set up to, I mean, it's just the nature of marketing and selling is the only, most of the time, the way that a product can be sold to you is to tell you that you're not good enough, but you'll be good enough when you have this mm-hmm. thing. And so I think that's been my biggest, and that literally, it's funny you ask me that, because I literally had that thought this morning that, you know, I actually really like myself. And I think that it's taken me a long time to get to mm-hmm. that place.
Mm-hmm. And how many societal messages there are that prevent you from feeling that in such a way, like you say, that we're told that we're not necessarily good enough, or that we should be doing better, that we can do better by doing this or using this product or trying this new experience. I feel like there is such a misunderstanding or a misconception of pride in self. Almost like we feel like we shouldn't be, or we're kind of messaged to feel like we shouldn't be proud of ourselves, or that it's been bragging, or that it comes across mm-hmm. as arrogant or overconfident mm-hmm. or whatever. And that there's been so many negative things put towards that feeling, and it shouldn't be. I mean, I think it's so beautiful that you've acknowledged that you like yourself and that you're proud of yourself, and that that should be modeled for the rest of the world to see.
You know, it's such an interesting thing, and in that you're absolutely right. We're taught from a very early age, like I know when I was little, it's like, don't brag. Mm-hmm. That's not nice. Like you don't have to tell people that you did well. You don't, like, it's almost like to make yourself small. Yes. Because then that makes other people feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think, gosh, like that's a terrible thing to teach young people, to even as grown-ups. And I see, you know, where I see particularly is women. Mm-hmm. I think women are the worst at this, where even a basic thing, like the number of times I've paid somebody a compliment. I'm in the back when we could go to malls. Mm-hmm. I'm in the mall and I see a woman who's wearing a nice outfit or whatever, and I'll pay her a compliment. And I 9 times out of 10, there'll be some deflection.
Yes.
I rarely ever have anybody just say, oh, thank you for noticing. Or, you know, it'll always be like, oh, this thing, oh, this is from 2 seasons ago. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, we always diminish ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, gosh, like the message, because if you think about the most powerful voice ever is the voice that is between your 2 ears, mm-hmm. what you say to yourself all day, every day. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the most powerful things that I'm learning is that matters. Because even though no one else can hear it, it's that dialogue that's going on constantly. You're not good enough. You're stupid. You're yeah. this. You did. You should have done better on that. Gosh, like it's we'd never speak like that to a friend, a relative, whatever. And yet we spend so much time putting ourselves down. So that for me is why the being proud of myself, because I literally would blitz from achievement to achievement to achievement, and I wouldn't even notice it, you know. Mm-hmm. I it would just be like, okay, next. I'd yep. never take this. I don't wanna brag. I don't wanna mm-hmm. like, there's so many. My brother-in-law came to visit last year, and we were cleaning out my storage locker. And in there was a trophy. And he's like, oh, what is this? And I'd never even told my family that I'd won this, a really significant award. I'd taken the trophy and hidden it. Because I was like, I don't want people to think anything of me. So I think, gosh, if there is one thing that I hope that we embrace as people, not just as women, as people, is taking time to be proud of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. That's a mega message. If you reflect and you think on the things in your life, in what ways have you made yourself smaller or tried to shrink yourself to fit in?
I literally spent my entire teens, 20s, 30s just trying to make myself small. Even when I look back as far back as school, I didn't want to be the smart kid. So I was intelligent, but I didn't do homework. I didn't, you know, study, because then I would stand out in some way, and then my friends wouldn't like me because I was smart. And so I literally feel like I went through all of my life just kind of minimizing my achievements or in some ways hiding my achievements because then people might not like me, you know? Mm. So there's so many things. Even now, I'm telling you, like I won this award and you wouldn't see the trophy anywhere. It's hidden in my storage locker because I don't want people to feel uncomfortable. And even talking about things I've done, it still feels like, oh, you know, when people say, oh my gosh, you're so great at this. Or, oh my gosh, you did this for me. Or me seeing you inspired me. It kind of still feels like, oh, like so much of almost like imposter syndrome. Like, mm-hmm. oh, if you only knew like that I really don't have my life together, you know. Yeah. So it's definitely something I'm working on.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about your background with documentaries and journalism and how you got into that.
My husband affectionately calls that time in my life my midlife crisis.
Oh.
I was not one of the people who grew up knowing that one day I would go to Columbia Journalism School. Like I had classmates who literally from when they were young knew that Columbia was the home of the Pulitzers and the DuPonts and they wanted to go to Columbia. I stumbled upon it. So how it happened was my husband was looking to do a PhD. And so we were in San Diego and there was a career fair, university fair, where all these universities were there, talking about their programs, their PhD and master's programs. And I had never thought about, did I want to do anything? I had a master's in marketing, and I thought that was it. And my career at that time was in management consulting. And so I went with my husband, just, hey, San Diego, nice day out. You know, that's as much as I was looking to do. And when we got there, like, it was a massive fair across a huge campus, and we walked in, and the very first, I mean, there are many ways that you could have gone into this fair. The very first stand that we came to was Columbia Journalism School. And there was a gentleman there of color. And just for the context, this was a predominantly very white, there weren't a lot of people of color here. And so for me, that was really what drew me was, oh, wow, a guy. To be clear, I didn't even know Columbia was an Ivy League university. So I that was what drew me was, oh, a person of color, let me go talk to him and hear what he's here and what's this program he's here to represent. And that's how I struck up a conversation with, his name is Leon Braswell, who was the admissions director at Columbia Journalism School. We had a conversation, turned into like, literally, I think I was there for an hour and a half. And at the end of the conversation, he said to me, you know, you're not our typical profile of a candidate for our school. It's incredibly hard to get into. They get literally thousands of applications and they only take 200 students a year. I really think you would be a great storyteller and you would make such an impact in story. I think you should apply. And so that was really the first time I thought, what do you do again? Like, what do you have? Mm-hmm. And that kind of led to me applying, led to me being accepted into the program. I literally walked in my very first day of class. My first day of class, I was 40 years old. 40. I was the oldest. I literally was, like, there were people in my class who were younger than my daughter. And I didn't know how to work a camera. I've never worked a camera before. And that was kind of my introduction mm-hmm. to journalism. It was an incredibly challenging program, but it was also one of the most incredible times in my life. I learned so much, mm-hmm. Both about myself, but also about the power of story and how story moves us and how we communicate through story. And that really was what then triggered my interest in documentary filmmaking and then also ultimately where I am now in terms of using story, but in a slightly different way. And certainly not as a journalist. I'm not aspiring to be the next Christiane Amanpour.
With journalism, do you find that the storytelling aspect of what you did or what you were working through at Columbia has kind of made you, or have you brought the interest in knowing people's stories forward into this event, for example, the Women on Fire Summit?
You know what's so interesting is actually I always had an interest in story. Always. Mm-hmm. I just didn't necessarily think of it in the box of journalism. Mm-hmm. So from when I was a little girl, like literally my memories of my grandmothers are all around story and them telling mm-hmm. stories. My memory of my dad is him reading Jack and the Beanstalk to me and my brother and doing all the voices and just connecting with the power of people's stories. And you know, one of the things that I used to get told all the time, every school report said, Sandra talks too much. But what it was I don't necessarily think that I was talking. I was asking questions because I was always fascinated by people and what drove them and why they were doing and what they were doing. And so I was a very curious kid. I was always asking questions. And so that, I think, is really where my love of story came from, is just being curious. Because one of the things that I learned even before I went to Columbia Journalism School is that everybody has a story. Doesn't matter who it is that you know, my husband has this amazing gift where he can talk to anybody. Like, he will get on a plane and he will, we've literally had this happen. We were on a flight from London to Calgary, London, England to Calgary, which is what, a 9-10 hour flight. And he and the person next to him talked every single minute of the way because, as my husband said, like, his story was so interesting. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've always loved being curious about people and what drives them and where they've come from and things like that.
Mm-hmm. How did you guys meet?
We met 30 years ago. Our brothers, both of us have our youngest, I have one brother, he's one of six, so his youngest brother were at the same school. And our brothers were both in the Christmas play and they were sheep in the Christmas play on stage. And so my mom forced me to go see my brother in the Christmas play. His mom forced him to go see his brother in the Christmas play. And we happened to sit next to each other and struck up a conversation. And here we are 30 years on.
Oh my gosh. I love love. I am such a sucker for love stories and just real connection as well. How do you maintain a connection with your African roots?
Being African is... We have an expression in Africa where it translated, it would say, I guess, a daughter of the soil. I believe that who I am is, I can never take that out of me. It's such a proud part of my identity. And so I maintain that. First of all, I go home so frequently. I think last year I went to Zimbabwe four times. I can't remember how many times. So that has always been so important for me to keep grounded in that way and to actually go and visit. I still have a lot of family that are in Zimbabwe, so I stay connected in that way. And reading is another way that I really stay connected. And then more recently, I started a podcast which tells the stories of inspiring, trailblazing women of African descent. So that's another way that I really keep connected with the stories of Africa. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's such an important part of who I am and it's shaped so much of who I am.
Mm-hmm. And you still have lots of family back in Zimbabwe?
I do. Unfortunately, my dad passed away. It'll be a year next month. Mm-hmm. But my mom is still in Zimbabwe. I have, in our culture as well, like, one of the things is I have my immediate family, which is, you know, obviously my mom, my dad, my brother. But then in our culture, we don't have the concept of cousins. There is no such thing. Like, even there is no word for a cousin in Africa because, or at least in my language, because as far as everybody's concerned, they are just as much your siblings. So even in terms of mothers, I have my biological mother, but I also have all of her sisters and all of my dad's sisters are all my mothers as well. Mm. So very much in our culture, the concept of a village, it takes a village to raise a child, that literally is so true. So even though, like, my blood sibling doesn't live in in Zimbabwe. I have many quote unquote siblings who are still in Zimbabwe, who are in South Africa, who are in Nigeria, who are, yeah. So I'm very much connected.
Yeah. When travel opens back up, I cannot wait to get back to Africa. I spent about 8 weeks in South Africa, Botswana, and Zimbabwe in the beginning of 2016. Actually, it's a really neat story because you know when you meet someone and you feel super connected to them and you just feel like you've known them for life. So I met this woman. I was traveling around in Australia. I lived there for just over 2 years, a couple of years ago. And we had mutual friends, and it was kind of indirectly her family and friends of mine. And we ended up at this family reunion birthday party, and I needed to get to the Brisbane airport and they were going back to Brisbane. And so I hitched a ride with them instead of taking the train down, they offered. And so for the hour, this woman named Jilly, hi Jilly, Jilly listens to the podcast. So Jilly and I just talked the whole way. And when we got out of the truck and I was getting my bag and getting ready to go to the airport, we just hugged each other, and there was just this knowing that we were going to be connected forever. She said to me, Amanda, you are always welcome in South Africa. Just come stay with us. And I said the same thing. I said, you are always welcome in my home in Canada. Just come and I will host you. I can't wait to stay connected. So sure enough, a couple of years go by and we're still talking on WhatsApp. We'll have the occasional Skype chat, whatever. And then I just, on a whim, I started booking tickets to Africa, and I reached out to her, and I guess it was 2015 where I was just kind of starting to reach out, and then 2016 I was more, this is what's happening, and I booked the tickets, and I went, and it was just like we picked up where we left off, and I went to the other side of the world to spend 8 weeks using this woman's home as a home base, and I had known her for 1 hour.
Oh, wow.
You know, like that is connection.
But isn't that amazing? That is, you're absolutely right. That is connection, in that I think sometimes we feel like, oh, to have a strong relationship with someone, I need to have known them for 30 years. And I need, no, there's some relationships. I have some of these friendships, you know, where they're girlfriends, where I literally met you a minute ago, but it feels like we're sisters. It feels like we've known each other for a lifetime.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And What was your experience like?
I loved it so much. Everything about it. I kind of kept to myself a little bit while I was traveling. I rented a car. I did the garden route by myself. I flew around. And the neat thing was that she had some connections, family connections, and some timeshares throughout Kruger and up through Botswana and Zim, which was really neat as well. We saw Vic Falls. We spent some time in Harare. Like, I just, honestly, when I think back, I just felt so welcomed. I felt safe. There were a few places that I didn't, in Cape Town in particular. And I think that if you know Cape Town, that there's some districts that you really need to be aware of.
Yeah.
But overall, I was blown away. The history there, the culture there, the food there, just all of it. And it's always been on my list to go back. And there's so much to explore there. So I've been doing a bit of research here on and off, and I don't want to get too excited because I don't know what's going on in the world and when I can actually get back to my traveling. But definitely, oh my gosh, I think back so fondly on it. So welcoming. And obviously there were some things even too that culturally were so different for me to experience there. Even just the help that Jilly's home had, but were help, but they weren't just help. They were family, and they all worked together, and there was such respect and love and just peace in and around their community.
Yeah, I hear you. It is special. It's hard to explain it to someone who's never been. And that's one of the things, you know, that is unfortunate. I mean, of course, in any of those countries, you know, as you've rightly said, you know, there are areas where you have to be concerned. There are areas where you have to be careful. But I think that's the same anywhere. Like, I mean, yes, some places are safer than others.
Absolutely.
But it is just generally, like, universally, wherever you go, people are so warm and so welcoming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and something that always strikes me is you will go, or I will go places where they literally have nothing. But the joy that is there is just, you know, just joy.
This is kind of like one of my takeaways. So I'm a teacher. I teach high school, but I spent a lot of years teaching elementary as well. And emotionally, there were just some experiences and some things that I saw while I was there, that in the little suburb next to where she was, people were living with next to nothing, you know, and they are living in mud huts with quite literally rocks holding on pieces of tin onto their roofs and steel and hanging what they have left of clothing out on clothing lines. And I mean, obviously, that is such a snippet of the multitude of things that I have seen in my travels around the world. But there was something in particular about the joy that was on these kids' faces when they are kicking around a deflated soccer ball. And that just, it brought me to tears. I remember driving with Jilly and I actually had her stop and I just needed to drink it in because I knew what I was coming back to. And I remember the school that I came back to and I was right back into supply teaching within 2 days of flying back. And I remember the way that a complaint hit my heart when a student was talking about how the Wi-Fi didn't connect and that the water fountain wasn't cold. And here's me. And like, they don't know any different. They don't know about privilege. They don't know how to acknowledge and recognize that, right? But so much of me was ready to just combust. And then the other side of me just really took that as a learning opportunity and a teaching moment so that we could kind of turn that into just a moment of gratitude and really acknowledging what we have. And, but oh my gosh.
You know, I completely agree with you that I think, you know, if you've never experienced it, you know, if you think about it, if you've only ever known, you know, living in wherever in Canada or the United States where it's an assumed when I go turn on the light switch, there will be electricity. And it's an assumed that when I turn the faucet, there will be clean water that'll come out. And so it's hard for you to even, I think it'd be hard as someone who's experienced both, right? I literally was born and raised in a mud hut with no running water, no electricity. I have relatives right now who live in mud huts with no running water, no electricity. So I have this huge spread of experience where I go from I'm in a five-star hotel and, you know, driving this whatever, and then I go home and I'm going to visit people who have nothing. And I imagine if you're coming from the quote-unquote first world, you can't eat. It's like right now, what it'd be like for me to try and explain to my 10-year-old nephew what it was like before there was internet and cell phones that could actually fit in your pocket. You know, he just doesn't get it. Nope. Or rotary dial. Like he saw a rotary dial phone and he was like, he couldn't figure, like, how did this work?
That's right, yeah.
Like he was so blown away because it's never been part of his experience. So in many ways, I don't fault the kids who have privilege because they don't know any different. And I think that's part of the power of story and sharing it as story to say, hey, this is what you have. But there are these other kids who look, you know, who are the same age as you, but who have a very different life. And I think that's a powerful thing. The other thing which I so admire in you is your bravery in travel. Right, is when you're so open to going and experiencing new things and going new places, even if it's within your own country, it just opens you up to, oh, different perspectives and oh, people live differently. And like all of this, you'd never have that from reading it in a textbook. So I think as parents as well, there's such richness for us to expose our kids, even if, you know, and I know, like, you know, not everyone can afford to go travel everywhere. Even if we can expose our kids to it through film or through books or, you know, whatever, I think there's such power in that.
Travel gives you an education that no institution ever can, because you learn so much about yourself, about culture, about food, about the world, about just life in general. And like you say, I mean, if you have the opportunity and the means to do so, even if it is within your own country, it's magic. And I feel so dang fortunate to have had the experiences that I have, because every single place I've gone, every single town I've visited, every person I've come in contact with along the way has just become a part of my travel story. And it's a very special one. It means a lot to me. It's helped shape me for sure.
Definitely.
I feel like I could talk to you for days. So
I know.
I love this. I have two more questions for you. What do you want to be known for?
Oh, I want to be known as someone who inspired other people to believe in their own possibility. I want to let people know. I want to be part of helping people understand that they are infinite possibility, that the world is their oyster, for lack of a better way to put it. And I think that there's so much that we as people, I think, and especially as women, don't understand about how we're capable of doing anything that we set our minds to. So I want to be part of helping people recognize their own power.
Mm. That's so beautiful. And if you had a message for the world and for everyone listening, what would it be?
It would be related to what I just answered, which is that you are infinite possibility.
Mm.
You are infinite possibility. And the only thing that stands in your way is you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we really don't understand how powerful we are and how powerful our thoughts are in creating whatever it is, the life of your dreams, the invention that you're dreaming of, the money, the whatever it is. And I think as well, one of the most powerful things that we don't always recognize is the power of our own words,
mm-hmm.
how what we say about ourselves is so important. One of my all-time favorite books is The Four Agreements. And one of the first agreements is be impeccable with your word.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so often we interpret that as, oh, be impeccable with our word when we're speaking to other people. But I think be impeccable with your word when you're speaking to yourself and
mm-hmm.
what you speak to yourself as your possibility.
Mm-hmm. The untethered soul is another great one. When you start looking at what's going on inside your mind. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, this has been so great. If people are interested in following along, which I can imagine they are going to be, where can they find you on social media?
This has been so great. And like you said, I literally feel like we could talk. So,
I know.
I don't know.
Especially because even pre-recording, like we locked in like another 20 minutes in addition to this. So.
I know. It'll be great one day soon when we can actually meet in person.
Yes.
I think that'll be so wonderful to actually meet in person.
And I'm a hugger, so get ready.
Oh, I'm a hugger too. I think people are sometimes taken aback because I'm like, I'm not going to shake your hand. I hug.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
So to answer your question about where can people find me on social, I am on Instagram as sandra.chuma, and my surname, my last name is spelled C-H-U-M-A. So you can find me on Instagram, sandra.chuma. I am on Facebook as well as Sandra Chuma, and my website is sandrachuma.com. And you can also find, because we talked a lot about it, about Woman on Fire, the summit that is going to be coming soon, as soon mm-hmm. as we can have in-person stuff. And that you can find on Instagram, Woman on Fire Summit. And you can also find it us on our website, which is Woman on Fire Summit.
Amazing. Sandra, thank you so, so much for your time today. It means the world to me.
It means the world to me to have somebody like you be interested in sharing my story.
Mm.
And like I said to you before, I am so grateful to you for having the courage to step into your fears and create this platform where you get to share stories from so many amazing people, because we all see each other in other people's stories. So
mm-hmm.
I love what you're doing. And
thank you so much. It means a lot.
Increased power to you and success.
Thank you so much
for what you do.
I appreciate you.
We will meet in person one day.
Yes, we will. Absolutely, we will.
Take care. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Sandra, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your stories and perspectives with me. I honor and appreciate you so much, and I'm really looking forward to meeting you in person. To everyone listening, I recognize the privilege that comes with my platform, and I am committed to diversifying the content and to creating more of an inclusive space. I am listening, I am learning, and I am unlearning. I am shifting my releases over the coming months to honor the Black community and to amplify Black voices. I am committed to maintaining an inclusive space from here on out. If today is the start of your journey into the depths of anti-racism, learning and unlearning old ways, be kind to yourself. Try not to feel burdened by shame or guilt. Keep moving. Keep growing. Keep leading with love. I encourage you to diversify your own content and who you're following, and to understand the difference between diversity and inclusion. The work can be difficult, but it is necessary and it is long overdue. If you haven't already, go start now. And I will talk to you next week.